So on Friday night, Stephanie and I went to Boston to see the Broadway musical, The Book of Mormon. Anybody seen it? A few. I'm still trying to process what I feel about it, and if you've seen it, you'll understand that. It did win 9 Tony Awards just a few years ago, but there's one song in it that particularly applies to our gospel today. So at the very beginning, you've got these two Mormon missionary trainees. Actually, they've just graduated from missionary school, 19 years old, bright as a penny, and they're getting ready to ship out for their 2-year missionary work. And Elder Kevin Price, who's 19, sings a song entitled, "You and Me, But Mostly Me." He's there with his companion, the guy who's going to be on this trip with him, and he sings, "Now it's time to go out and set the world's people free, and we can do it together, you and me, but mostly me." You and me, but mostly me, are going to change the world forever because I can do most everything. They're 19, idealistic, bright, and ego-driven, just like the apostles this morning. You remember? Some of you can remember. Some of you aren't there yet can remember being 19. I remember being 19 and idealistic and on fire for God. So I want to go easy on those Mormon missionaries, and I want to go easy on the apostles who spend their time in the gospel arguing about which of them is the greatest. There are two different ways to look at that. I mean, you could say, oh, they're just sitting around all pretending to be Donald Trump and I'm the greatest and I can do it all. And I don't think that's what's going on. I think they're arguing about who is the most helpful to Jesus and his mission of proclaiming the kingdom. So Andrew may say, well, you remember, I'm the one that found a little lad, a little boy with the 5 loaves and the 2 fish. And without that, guys, there's no feeding of the 5,000. And Peter says, oh, you think that's something? I'm the one who said in Caesarea Philippi that he was the Messiah, the Christ. And then I imagine by this time, Mary Magdalene, who's probably older and wiser, she finally chimes in and says, well, remember, guys, I'm one of the few people here who's actually bankrolling this mission. And you can read about that in Luke 8 if you want to. So these are not grandiose rants, but nonetheless, Jesus sits down, which means he's getting ready to teach, because a rabbi sat when he taught, and he's going to tell them that his definition of being great, being a great lover, a great teacher, a great healer, is upside down compared to the way the world understands greatness. Now, all they have to do is look at each other to remember that Jesus did not pick white-collar Bible scholars from Jerusalem to be part of his inner circle, right? He didn't. He picked blue-collar, uneducated fishermen from Galilee as his core group. Paul, in 1 Corinthians, puts it this way, "Consider your own call, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, the things that are not, to reduce to nothing things that are, so that no one might boast in the presence of God." Now, just as an aside, this does bear some thinking on our part, because most Episcopal churches I've been associated with are filled not with the low and despised, but the well-educated elite, like us. Something to think about. But the disciples know where they've come from, and none of them is going to be tempted to crash some Boston socialite's, you know, wedding downtown. But what they are tempted to forget is that the greatness and the kingdom is not about climbing up, but it's about climbing down. The path to greatness is climbing down to serve, and that includes the marginal and the unimportant. We all know this. We hear this all the time. Makes me think of Pope Francis is coming. very exciting, right? Be here, I think, Tuesday sometime. Sorry he's not coming to Boston, but that'll help the traffic at least. But you know, there have been times when popes and cardinals and bishops, both Roman Catholic and Anglican, Episcopalian, have climbed the ladder up and have, you know, big pleasure palaces along the great rivers of Europe. But this pope, choosing the name of Francis of Assisi, has chosen not to live in the palatial papal apartments, right, but in ordinary apartments on the Vatican grounds. And it's clear, not just in his rhetoric, but in his heart, he wants and he does pay attention to the marginalized, which, of course, are the billions on the earth. The marginalized aren't the one or two who are left out. They're the billions who are left out. So we should pay close attention to who does he visit when he comes here. Now, of course, he's going to go to the White House, and he's going to address a joint session of Congress. That ought to be something, because he'll make them all squirm, which is probably the sign that he's on to something. But let's look at who he will visit, who he will spend his time with. But let's go a little deeper, because we're not going deep enough if we think Jesus is simply telling us and the disciples, okay, guys, you just need to follow a progressive social agenda. You need to spend more time with the marginalized. He's certainly saying that. We do need to serve the powerless, without question. But he also says, when you embrace this little child is an icon for his larger point, you are also embracing me, he says. And more than this, you're actually, get this, when you embrace that child, you are embracing the creator of the universe. Now that too requires a lot of thought and prayer. But he says it, you welcome this child, you're welcoming me, and not just me, but the one who sent me. Jesus is asking us to look at the world and everybody in it from his point of view. Now, we all know that's not our default. That's not my default point of view. My default point of view is, of course, the ego that continually divides up the field of experience into 10,000 things and then judges those things I like and those things I don't like. The good, the bad, the right, the wrong. I get it all organized so the ego can feel like it's got a handle on things. Continually making judgments about what's going on, which means I am no longer experiencing what's going on. So follow this point. You've heard it before. The human mind can judge something, or it can experience something, but it cannot do both at the same time. So, common experience we've all had, a walk in the woods. We've had those times where we go and our mind is just in a million places, right? Maybe we're angry, we're worried, whatever. We get in the woods and all we may do either is think about what's coming or what's just happened, or the ego is in ascendancy and it just divides it up. So, oh, isn't that a pretty flower? That's a big, nice, big tree. Oh, that's an ugly thing. That thing is bad. And those people, they didn't pick up the dog poop. And it just listing all the good things and all the bad things and not experiencing any of it. And then we've had those walks, right, that are glorious. You go in and you become, to borrow a phrase, one with nature. Maybe that's when we're on vacation and we've left our monkey mind behind. That time of peace and tranquility and peace. And we leave that walk feeling rejuvenated and healed and transformed. We feel that we are connected to it all. I think that's the way my dog experiences all his walks, because he's only concerned with the thisness in front of him, right? The thisness. Where I get, you know, maybe there physically, but emotionally or mentally may not be anywhere close by. And that means that I miss not only what's right in front of me, you know, that flower, that mailbox, that snake, and that can be a frightening experience. I got used to not seeing a lot of snakes up here, but over where I live, there are a lot of snakes. And I don't like snakes, just by the way. So if you bring one on the blessing of the pets thing, have it on a leash. You know what I mean? But if I don't just see those things, it also means I'm not seeing what's even behind that. I don't realize I'm not connecting to the presence of God. So it can be a profound spiritual experience just to walk up to a tree. Try it this afternoon. Pick any tree. Walk up to the tree and just commune with the tree. You might want to do that when you're alone. But just feel its presence. And you'll feel your own presence. And if that's too weird to practice, another practice is just every moment during the day when you realize you are distracted by the monkey mind, to just say the words, just this. You just go to whatever's in front of you. Just this. This is what I'm going to pay attention to now. Just this. And you go along and then that changes. Now it's just this. Week ago, Saturday, I would call the rector at St. Anne's Lincoln to give me directions to their church for the interment of Ed Gilbert. And she said, now you're going to go down Concord Road, you're going to go right by Walden Pond. And she said, you got to be careful because last week, so that'd be 2 weeks ago, three people got hit by cars. And so I just have to picture this. So you got people. They got their coolers and their chair, and they can't wait to get in Walden Pond to have a thorough experience of being one with what is. But they're already in the park, so they don't see cars and people walking in the middle of the street. You see the irony there? And of course, it means when they get in the park, they're now thinking about what they're going to do when they leave the park. And they're going to miss it all together. The trees will forgive us. You can always go back to a tree and be present to the tree, and the tree will be present to you. Spouses, however, can be less forgiving. You've had that experience where you're talking about something really important, and you just see the glaze happen, and they're no longer listening. We're not as good as realizing when we're the ones that are doing that. So Scripture today is telling us you can judge the child. And insert whatever you want for child in that. Cute, ugly, smart, slow, clean, dirty. Or you can experience the child. Giving her our presence, receiving her presence, and realizing we're all in the presence of God. And so I think Jesus is calling us not just to serve the poor, but to see the poor. To see human beings, this person here, and to be a person with them there. Let them be present to us. And remember, in all of this, we're not talking about things we do to make God show up. We're talking about how to live so that we have the eyes to see and the ears to hear the God who is already and always present.